Good evening and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. We have a great show coming up in the next hour. In the first 30 minutes, I'll be talking with Howard Weaver, former Anchorage Daily News editor and author of recently published book, Write Hard, Die Free, Dispatches from the Battlefields and Barrooms of the Great Alaska Newspaper War. In the second half of the show, I'll be playing a pre-recorded interview I did with Colleen Mondor, author of The Map of My Dead Pilots, a book based on her experiences as lead dispatcher at a commercial air carrier based out of Fairbanks. I want to remind all the listeners that you can be a part of the Alaska Identity Project. Find the show on Facebook, like the show, and stay up to date with all of the weekly interview guests and the recordings as well. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Alaska ID Project, or go to my blog, adriennechile.blogspot.com, and see pictures that I take with all of the guests. Howard Weaver was born in Anchorage, Alaska, and educated at Anchorage Public Schools. He graduated from East Anchorage High School, received a BA degree from Johns Hopkins University, and a Master of Philosophy from Cambridge. Weaver twice led the Anchorage Daily News to Pulitzer Prizes. He wrote the story for which the paper won the 1976 Pulitzer Prize Gold Medal for Public Service, and was editor and a lead writer on the project for which the paper again won that prize in 1989. In October 1976, Weaver was one of five people who started the Alaska Advocate, a statewide weekly newspaper. When it folded in 1979, he returned to the Daily News as an editorial writer. He later served as daily columnist, managing editor, and then assumed full editorial responsibility in 1983. In 1995, he moved to Sacramento to assume a new position as assistant to the president for new media strategies at McClatchy Newspapers. He has four times served as Pulitzer Prize juror by invitation and is a member of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, in addition to other professional organizations. Whew, in 1988, he was named by Alaska Public Radio Network Survey as one of the 40 most influential Alaskans in the state's first 40 years of history. I didn't read everything, Howard, but I got most of it, I think.
Well, that sounded very impressive. I don't know. I did all that stuff.
It is impressive, and I want to thank you for the book. I managed to get through it. It was good that I was on an airplane. That helps.
Yes, it does.
Have focused attention. First of all, you're in Juneau talking about Write Hard, Die Free, but you've also been speaking around Alaska. How has the reception been to you and your book?
It's really been very gratifying, and I know I had some old friends left, and so I didn't expect to be by myself at any of these appearances, but there have actually been a lot of folks who turned out in Anchorage and Palmer and Fairbanks, and then last night, of course, in Juneau, we had a couple of events that were very well attended, and most important to me, filled with people who actually had good comments and good questions, because as you and I were talking just briefly before, I hope that this book will be the start of a conversation and not the end of a conversation, because, you know, the questions, even though it's a history book in its way, I think the questions are very contemporary for Alaska in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, they are. There are. Now, for those of who aren't aware, the listeners out there, of this Great Alaska Newspaper War, could you give us kind of a summary? I know it was a 20-year period, and basically your role throughout that in the Anchorage Daily News.
It's the Newspaper War, I suppose, in a sense, went on a lot longer than that. I picked the period of time when I was intimately involved in it because I knew that was the time I could write about most authentically.
Yeah.
It's not a history book in the sense that I'm not a scholar and I didn't follow all the conventions of scholarly history, but I tried to make it obviously as honest as I could and as factual as I could, and from my perspective, this is the story. There are other perspectives, and I hope that they will be shared in various ways. But so anyway, I picked the time. I graduated from college and went back to Anchorage in 1972 and went to work full-time. I'd actually worked there in high school, but but I went to work full-time in 1972, and the Anchorage Times folded in 1992. So that's a convenient 20-year period. Mm-hmm. And then 3 years later, I left Alaska, so I extended the book by those 3 years just to encompass that. It was a pitched battle, really. It was maybe slightly hyperbolic to call a lot of things a war, but we felt like it was a war. And we were all pretty sure that only one of us was going to finish alive, and so that kept us very focused throughout this time. The Daily News had been founded. The Times was very much the older paper, very much the larger paper, more influential. It had been there since 1915, really before there was an Anchorage officially. It was This will sound familiar to people in Juneau. The people that founded Anchorage were quite acquisitive, and they wanted everything, so they took the newspaper away from Kinnick, Alaska, and moved it to Anchorage.
Really?
Much the same way they later tried to move the university and the capital and a bunch of other things. But so the Times was very much the dominant newspaper in Anchorage and in the state.
Mm.
The Daily News was founded in the late 1940s as a weekly, primarily to be a voice of the anti-statehood movement. So we were on the losing side of a number of arguments throughout our history. That was one of them. But it kind of, I think, gave the paper its underdog fervor. And so it became a daily newspaper shortly after it was founded. And not too long after that became the first Alaska paper both to be a morning paper and to be a Sunday paper.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a few things going for it, mm-hmm. but the Times retained a huge circulation lead. When I started there, it was probably... maybe there were 10,000 subscribers to the Daily News and 45,000 subscribers to the Anchorage Times. And in terms of finances, it was even more lopsided. They were mm-hmm. making a lot of money. We were actually losing a lot of money and being mm-hmm. subsidized by our owner, who was a wealthy woman, but as it turned out, not limitlessly wealthy.
Okay.
So we went through a lot of different phases of that war. When I started, it was an independent paper. Kay Fanning was the owner and publisher. She and her husband had bought the paper not long before, and then he died, a kind of classic newspaper death, fell down at his desk with a heart attack, and all at once Kay Fanning was the boss. She took over and was running the paper when I got back there. Shortly after that, the Times and the News entered into an agreement called a joint operating agreement, where they would combine all operations except newsrooms. There would be separate competitive newsrooms, but the advertising sales and circulation and production of the newspaper would take place out of one office. The theory being that would make it a lot more efficient. There would be enough money then to sustain two separate newsrooms. But there was no guarantee that it would, and the people at the News, including Mrs. Fanning, certainly thought the Times didn't try very hard to sell subscriptions to the Daily News or to serve our circulation very efficiently. And so a few years after that, she filed suit claiming that the contract had been broken and that the Times really didn't follow through. By that point, I was at another newspaper, the Alaska Advocate, and actually covering that trial. And I remember describing it as a loveless marriage and talked about the trial as a divorce. And I think that was actually pretty descriptive. And so the two newspapers were agreed in court. There was a court settlement. The Times gave the Daily News $750,000, but it had to become independent, had to hire all those other departments that we didn't have, the circulation and mm-hmm. production and so on, and had to do that within 6 months. So there was really very little chance that the Daily News could pull that off until Kay sold 80% of the paper to this California company, McClatchy. Very experienced newspaper company. It had been in business since the first McClatchy paper was the Sacramento Bee, founded in the Gold Rush era of California. So maybe they had a little bit in common with Alaska in that sense. At least they were adventuresome. We know that because it was not a very smart business deal for them to do. But that gave the Daily News then finally the stability and the backing and to some degree the expertise that we needed to wage this campaign. And mm-hmm. over the course of the next 15 years, the Daily News overtook the Anchorage Times in circulation, ultimately in advertising as well, and then a few more iterations later, they folded.
They folded. Wow. And you were very much a part of that history. Uh-huh. Now, you said your philosophy was to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Do you think through your time with the News, the Daily News, you carried that out? Were there any specific examples of how that happened?
Well, that's an old newspaper saying. I don't remember exactly where it originated, but it's one that I certainly embraced,
mm-hmm.
and it made a lot of sense to me. And we always saw ourselves, for a variety of reasons, as trying to be the voice of the average reader, not to represent only the people who already had a powerful voice in the community, but to make sure all the voices were heard. And, that's a good philosophy. It's what I believed in, and sort of an egalitarian democratic system. But it was also turned out to be a really good competitive strategy because, among many other things, one of the Times' faults, from my perspective, was that they were pretty arrogant. They did not listen to the readers very much because they'd been in charge for so long, and they kind of thought, we know what's best, and you just read the paper and do what we tell you, and you'll all get along fine. And so for us, being the voice of the underdog was really a competitive advantage. And we took full advantage of it. I mean, it was sort of our instinct to do that, and it was Kay Fanning's philosophy to do that as a kind of a social do-gooder personality.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was also competitively smart. And we did it as vigorously. The best example I can think of is that in all the years that I lived and worked in Anchorage, I honestly cannot remember a single time that the Anchorage Times did any reporting or a series or anything like that that focused on disadvantaged Alaskans. Specifically, they really ignored Native Alaskans except when they weighed in to oppose movements for land claim settlements or sovereignty or really any influence. Noted Anchorage area Native leader Roy Hundorf, who was the first president of Cook Inlet Region, was quoted in the mid-70s in somebody else's book as saying when the Native corporations began to get a little economic clout, it was really tough for the Times because their greed was rubbing up against their racism.
Wow.
And I certainly believed that. And the Daily News, by contrast, had a long example, a long history of going out of its way to try and focus on rural Alaska, which is, you know, there's not really any ads to be sold by covering rural Alaska. Mm-hmm. The money's in Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau as a rule, but they had gone in the mid-60s out to do a big series called The Village People that resulted in congressional hearings and President Johnson appointing a commission, and a lot of things started to happen for Alaska Native peoples as a result of that. A few years later, they did a second, and then while I was editor, we did two more, culminating in the one in 1989 that won the Pulitzer Prize. So it was just something that we thought was integral to what being an Alaskan was. You know, an Alaskan is not just somebody who lives in town and has a split-level house and a heated garage. Alaska, to me, has always represented that sense of expansiveness and frontier and self-reliance, independence, those kinds of virtues. And, you know, there's certainly at least as present in rural Alaska and arguably much more present in rural Alaska than they are in some places in the suburbs of Anchorage, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get to that. Actually, on that note, you also talk about how newspapers define communities through these metaphors of tribal fires, right? Mm-hmm. There's a chapter on that. Do you think we've, as Alaskans, more or less progressed or maybe not progressed in this sense of shared community in our state?
That's a really good question, and I'm not sure I can articulate it well, but I can tell you what I think. And what I think is that it has not progressed. I've been personally, disappointed. I think I described it in the book as being heartbroken by some of the things that I saw happening in Alaska. And the way I describe it really is, the easiest way to describe it, I think, is this. I was born in Anchorage. And so whenever I'd go anywhere or do anything and I'd say I was born in Alaska, people would say, man, that's really cool. And I would say, actually, that means I have cool parents, right? I was just living in my hometown. How cool is that? But my parents were the kind of person that was widely represented in Alaska in those days. They were idealists.
Mm-hmm.
They were farm kids from Texas, and my dad went away to the war and came back after World War II, and they bought a pickup truck and drove to the end of the road. And that was Anchorage. You couldn't drive to Homer then or anything. So, you know, they were excited about the idea of being part of something new, some chance to start again, to build a community that was fairer and more representative. And, you know, Alaska as a whole was doing that. I mean, think about it. In those days, they were writing a constitution for a new state. Mm-hmm. It was like the founding fathers, except they were meeting in Fairbanks and and developing a constitution for Alaska. And it's still widely regarded as one of the ideal governance documents that's ever been drafted. It's a very progressive and smart constitution. And so in those days, people felt that, and I felt it even as a kid, that Alaska was special, that it was going somewhere special, that we didn't have to do things the way they had done them elsewhere. We didn't have to repeat the mistakes that had been made. And so there was a very strong sense of this idealism and community spirit. One of my old mentors had been a gold miner up in Tofty in the 1930s.
Tofty.
Tofty is near Fairbanks, or actually closer to Minto. But, and he was telling me that those days in Fairbanks, everything was sort of governed by what they called the code of the trail, which meant if somebody was in trouble, you helped them, right? Because if you didn't, they were going to die. And if they didn't help you, you were going to die. And so there was this very strong bond. And over time, it seems to me, perhaps inevitably as a result of modernization or population expansion or something else, it began to diminish. And I look at this as something that happened over the course of one generation, basically my generation. Okay. I went to high school in Anchorage and graduated in 1968, which was the year before the Prudhoe Bay oil leases. So I kind of say I was maybe the last generation of Alaskans to come of age pre-oil.
Mm.
And the oil era changed everything. It changed a lot of things for the better. There's a lot of nice facilities in Alaska that wouldn't be here otherwise. There's modernization. There are better hospitals. You know, a lot of things came as a result of the economic boom.
Yeah.
But also a lot of social dislocation came, a lot of crime and, you know, other problems. And I think some people would argue that it was also a real change in the attitude.
Mm.
Alaskans began to feel differently about their relationship with the government, their relationship with one another. And so somehow we went in my lifetime from this idealism of my parents to, just for a convenient metaphor, Sarah Palin.
You say that the last part of your
book. Well, and I don't, you know, I don't talk about Sarah Palin's politics or her rise because, of course, that happened after I left. But mm-hmm. I think what I said in the book is something like she's not responsible for Alaska's condition, but she is supremely representative of it. And
yeah.
I think that's true. And to me, at least, from my point of view, I would characterize that that position as being one that's much less community-minded and much more selfish.
Mm-hmm.
It's about paying as little tax as you can. It's about, exercising maximum personal opportunity. And there's certainly an articulated political philosophy that holds that. And I think it, you know, it's perfectly legitimate and deserves mm-hmm. to be debated and thought about. Personally, I don't find that an improvement.
Right.
I feel, and I really began to feel that long before Sarah Palin was on the radar screen, and it was at the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which was something that, I'm sorry to say, I had written about explicitly at least 10 or 11 years before.
You predicted it. I was going to ask. I couldn't remember where I read it, but you said
yeah.
you predicted this would happen.
Well, what happened
right?
was, I wouldn't quite claim credit for predicting it, but what I did say as a commentator was that this kind of thing seems inevitable. And what had happened was there was a big oil spill off the coast of France about 11 years before Exxon Valdez, and the Amoco Cadiz, as I remember. And it was a modern American-owned tanker. It wasn't some rusty old bucket, and it had this oil spill that really stained the beaches of Normandy, and there was no way to stop it. And it wasn't as big a spill as Exxon Valdez, and not nearly as destructive because it wasn't in a closed little perfect bay like Prince William Sound. But I said, you know, look, as long as this oil is being moved around in tankers by people whose objective is to maximize their profit, this is a real danger. And Alaskans need to think about not if it's going to happen, but when it's going to happen. And we need to be ready for that in all kinds of ways. And, you know, we really weren't. Since the pipeline started, the regulatory scheme had gotten less and less rigorous.
Dwindled.
The legislature appropriated less and less money for the Department mm-hmm. of Environmental Conservation mm-hmm. or for other environmental monitoring. The oil companies were allowed to reduce staffing on the tankers to eliminate, you know, some of the navigational aids.
Yeah.
And so it was just a steady march toward disaster. After the Exxon Valdez, in fact, the Daily News did a series I was very proud of called Blueprint for Disaster that kind of looked at, you know, how we should have seen this coming but mm-hmm. really didn't, or at least didn't do anything about it. So then the oil spilled, and it was, you know, for those who were in Alaska at those time, remember, it was a tragedy by all counts. And so Alaskans, I think, did respond briefly to that. And at least in my view, there was this outpouring of anger and of disappointment. And then there was some action. The legislature actually mm-hmm. did move. There were some regulations adopted that strengthened our ability to control it. There was additional funding provided for regulators and environmental conservation and so on.
Nationally, the Oil Spill Pollution Act. Right?
Was definitely a response. But very shortly after that, it seemed to me, Alaskans started to
roll over, you say.
Yeah, roll over to slip back maybe to the other attitudes. And the oil companies have been extremely effective over the years at identifying themselves with Alaska's prosperity. You know, you want jobs, you need oil companies. You want a new performing arts center, you need oil companies. You want a permanent fund dividend check, you need oil companies. And certainly oil companies have been the engine of almost all that development. But my observation and my position certainly would have been that that's incidental to the fact that they are also selling Alaskans oil at an enormous profit and making an enormous profit. And I say in the book, and it's always been true, I don't blame oil companies for acting like oil companies. Right? They are private capitalist organizations that are dedicated to optimizing and maximizing the profits. And so if they can do something cheaper, they will. I believe that they also, where the oil is the biggest determinant in that. And there's a bit of debate right now in Alaska, obviously, mm-hmm. about whether the state needs to lower oil taxes. And I can remember how I used to feel about people that came up from outside and told Alaskans what to do, so I'm not going there. I'm not going to be that guy. But I will say it's the same debate we had when I was here, and my position then was that, you know, obviously it shouldn't be onerous. The state wants to be a partner. The state wants cooperative but genuine cooperative mm-hmm. relations. And mm-hmm. and we, you know, I never argued that there shouldn't be an oil industry in Alaska. I know that people have to work. Yeah. And a place like Alaska, jobs are important and a source of income and dignity and all kinds of things. But I can remember when I was a kid, there was oil development on the Kenai Peninsula. There wasn't mm-hmm. anything yet on the North Slope. But my dad was in an argument with some neighbor of ours. And as I recall, Bill Egan, the governor, had proposed a very modest tax on this new industry, oil. And our neighbor said, you know, we're going to drive those oil companies out of Alaska. And my dad was from West Texas and had seen the oil development there. And he says, you know what? The Alaskan National Guard could not drive them out of Alaska mm-hmm. if there's oil here. If there's oil here, they'll be here. If there's not oil here, they'll go. I mean, nobody thinks that the oil companies are going to stay if they can't make a lot of money.
Sure.
And no reason they should. But it also means that while there's an opportunity to operate profitably, they will do so. And so that was my feeling and my philosophy, and it was articulated okay. plainly in the editorial columns of the Daily News, so it's not a revelation. But I was very disappointed to feel like the state had drifted away from that perspective.
So that was kind of the moment, Exxon Valdez, you said, when we kind of got away from
it. And I didn't understand that at the time.
Yeah.
I have to say, I just knew that it was, it felt like things had changed and that maybe there was a new chapter opening up for me. And that was personal as well as, you know, political and social. It was also had to do with the fact that the newspaper war was over.
Mm.
All of my career had been defined by competing against the Anchorage Times, and then literally overnight it went away.
No,
one day, to everybody's surprise, I mean, I was involved in some of the weeks leading up to it, but almost everybody picked up the Anchorage Times that morning and its headline said farewell, and that was the first they knew. And then that was the last day.
It
didn't come out the day after that. There was no, you know, ramping down. It was just over. And so that had changed the media landscape dramatically. And after a while, I sort of surveyed what I was doing and looked at, and it wasn't as much fun mm-hmm. without a competitor. Things had changed. And I was 45 years old. And so I was thinking, if I'm ever going to try something new, maybe this is the time to think about it. It's obviously easier to change course when you're 45 than when you're 55. And it was a surprise to me. I had expected to live and die in Alaska. I was a lifer mm-hmm. if ever there was one. You know, I was born here. I loved mm-hmm. it. I worked here. My wife had chosen to move to Alaska when she was a young woman in her 20s. Actually, she came to Juneau as a VISTA volunteer and worked for Rural Cap and other places. And yeah, I used to tell people that she came to Alaska to save the poor, ignorant Alaskans and only managed to save one, but thankfully it was me.
At least one.
And so we were both, you know, dedicated Alaskans. And I would have bet anything, you know, and I expected maybe I would get to edit the Daily News until I died, and then it just wasn't the right thing to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And people come to those kinds of landmarks in their life all the time, and this happened to be mine. And we mm-hmm. moved, and much to our surprise, we enjoyed it. There were new challenges. There were roads that we could drive that we didn't know what was at the end of them. You know, in Alaska, big as it is and rich as it is in opportunities, you know, I'd spent 45 years there, and I had been a lot of places, and I'd done a lot of things, and I wanted to try something new, so we did.
Yeah.
And there we are. We're still in California to this day.
Now, you kind of felt like you saw some of this, just like the Exxon spill, maybe the future of digital media or the changes that were coming in the newspaper world.
And that was part of it, too. It, was, it wasn't all reactive. It was partly, you know, looking out and seeing opportunities coming. And
mm-hmm.
I was a kind of computer hobbyist, one of those, you know, nerds early that had a computer in his house and a 300 baud modem, and I connected to things like CompuServe and Dialog.
Wow,
there
wasn't
no internet, per se, in those days. And there certainly was no World Wide Web. But it still was incredibly powerful. And I began to realize, when I could sit at home at 11 at night and dial into a library database, say in Boston, and look something up, that changes things. You know, you're no longer quite satisfied to wait until the library opens Monday morning before you go find something out. So I could see that this was going to be a change, and I was you know, kind of nagging the people at McClatchy to think that this was going to be important in the publishing business. And so that was the occasion of my getting that chance to go down and work for a year on internet publishing. And I say in the book that I was really proud of some of the things I predicted,
mm-hmm.
but I really feel badly that even having predicted them, I didn't do more to help the newspaper industry be ready for it.
Transform,
and so
yeah.
I wrestled with that a good bit. And like most things, I think the answer is a bit mixed. There were certainly things I could have done better, and there were things that the companies could have done better. But I finally came to the conclusion that in the end, it was pretty much destiny that these institutions were going to be severely wrenched by this change. Mm. It was just too big.
Inevitable.
And it's really a paradigm shift, to use that cliche, because we had been in the business of managing scarcity. You know, newspapers only came out once a day.
Yeah.
They had to be printed. They had to be delivered. And all of a sudden, the floodgates are open, and anybody can get any information, good information, bad information, true information, propaganda. It's all there now. And that's a managing abundance. And we were not equipped to do that, certainly at the beginning. And it's been a hard row mainly because of revenue issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, audience turned out not to be the problem. We were scared that the internet would steal all the audience from newspapers. Well, it turns out people like to read what their local newspaper does. And even today, I know it's true in Anchorage, and I'm sure it's true in Juneau as well, that if you take the newspaper's circulation and add to that the unduplicated reach of their websites, the audience is actually bigger than it used to be.
Mm.
More people read what the Daily News reporters write today than ever before. And yet, there's not revenue attached to that in the same way there used to be. And so, all the papers, and again, Anchorage is the one I know best, and it's a very difficult example. It's a much smaller news staff than it was when I was there 15 years ago. They're working much harder, you know, with fewer resources, trying to do the things they think they need to do, but less able to.
Yeah.
And that's the transition period we're in. And I think it's really, we're right in the middle of it. And the advice I used to give the newsrooms is something I heard somewhere. Somebody said, you know, when you're going through hell, keep going.
Keep going.
Because you've got to get out.
Yeah.
And so that's what I feel like about the media right now, is that it's in this transition period. It is hellish for those folks. I'm no longer in the thick of it, but it was my life for 40 years and kind of my religion in a lot of ways, and it hurts a lot to see this happening. But in the end, I think that there is reason to be optimistic, and so I keep soldiering on, and the people who are actually in the trenches, at the newspapers, in the newsrooms, wherever they may be, I think are you know, genuinely heroes.
Mm. Well, shout out to everybody there.
Yeah.
We're out of time, Howard, but I just want to thank you not only for coming on and for writing this book, Write Hard, Die Free, but also for all your contributions you've made to our state and helping define who we are as Alaskans.
Thank you. Can I say one quick thing about Juneau, which is I wanted to be sure and mention, because the other part of my journalistic career involved the Alaska Advocate, this weekly newspaper that we ran for a year and a half, two and a half years, and then I went back to the Daily News. But that was actually born in Juneau. I was covering the legislature. My colleague and friend, still good friend, John Greeley, was also working there. And we used to talk late into the night about what was wrong with the media and how we had ideas about reporting that we couldn't exercise and why there needed to be a new paper. And ultimately we started one and moved on. And that was a very essential part of my career. I learned more in those 2.5 years than I could have done anywhere else, I think. And frankly, that's one of the things that gives me a little optimism now, because I know somewhere there are a couple of young journalists like me and John Greeley trying to figure out those answers for the next era, and I think they're going to be successful.
Oh, great. That's good advice. That was something I also wanted to ask you. But thank you for coming on the show today, the Alaska Identity Project, and good luck with promoting your book and getting the message out and starting this conversation that we all need to have.
Thanks very much. I'll look forward to continuing it sometime.
Thanks, Howard. And to the listeners out there, you can stay tuned here on KTOO News. We'll be talking with Colleen Mondor, Map of My Dead Pilots, next on the show. Thanks.
The Juneau World Affairs Council presents Ron Bar Yosefat this Sunday, April 29th at 7 p.m. at the Jack. His topic, Understanding the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. A community organizer, Yosefat holds a law degree from Hebrew University and is working on an MBA from Tel Aviv University. This event is made possible with support from Sea Alaska, Wassman & Associates, GCI, Greens Creek, and Kensington. That's this Sunday, 7 p.m. at the Jack. Admission is free. More details at jwac.org.
CBJ is hosting a Household Hazardous Waste Cleanup Day this Sunday from 9 to 4:30. Items like old paint, varnish, pesticides, poisons, cleaners, and fluorescent bulbs are accepted. All batteries must have their terminals taped. If not taped, they must be individually placed in baggies, including household batteries. The Hazardous Waste Collection Facility is near Costco and is open to all Juneau households.
For information, call 780-6009. Thanks for participating in cleaning up Juneau's environment.
Welcome back to the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez. Thanks for staying tuned here on KTOO News, Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. We're having a great show tonight. In the second half, we'll be talking with author Colleen Mondor here in the studio. But before we get started with that interview, I'd like to remind listeners that you can find the Alaska Identity Project on Facebook, like the show there, stay up to date on the interviews on a weekly basis, and the pictures we take of all the amazing guests that come on here. You can also follow the show at Alaska ID Project on Twitter, and go to my blog, adriennechile.blogspot.com, and find the recordings of all of these interviews, as well as other pictures of the guests. Colleen Mondor is an essayist and book reviewer whose work appears regularly in Booklist, Eclectica Magazine, and Bookslut.com, where she is currently a monthly columnist. She has been published by various aviation magazines, including Flight Safety Digest, and she writes about Alaska aviation and polar exploration. She currently runs an aircraft leasing business with her husband and lives in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. She also keeps a blog at ChasingRay.com. Colleen, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you in Juneau. I guess you're doing an Alaska tour right now.
I am doing a tour. Juneau to Anchorage to Fairbanks, all in 6 days. So
6 days.
Which is a little crazy.
Well,
big space.
Did you lay that out? Is this kind of part of the book tour?
This is part of the tour for the book.
Great. Yeah. Which actually was not in the bio, so we should mention. The book we're going to be talking about tonight is The Map of My Dead Pilots, The Dangerous Game of Flying in Alaska by Colleen Mondor. And as I understand it, this was recently published.
It came out in November of last year, so just a few months ago.
Okay, great. So if you're in Juneau and you're interested in finding this book, I know for sure it's being sold at Hearthside.
Yes, it is.
And possibly other locations at some point. Now, Colleen, let's just kind of get some of the background. You were working for 4 years as a dispatcher at the company, which is in the book. Can you give us a little background on how
this
came about?
I have a degree in aviation management, which is just what it sounds like, a management degree that's tailored towards aviation. I learned to fly when I was 18 years old, and all of that was in Florida, which is where I am from. And in Florida, aviation is something that people need, but they also like to complain about a lot, the noise in particular. So a lot of the guys that I had gone to school with got jobs up in Alaska to fly, because if you want to build flight time, this is one of the places where you go. And all they could talk about was how it was this wonderful place that loved airplanes, and I was ready for an adventure. So I went to Fairbanks, and I call it the company in the book to protect the people that I worked with. The names are changed in the book, not because there's some startling revelations, but just because nobody that I worked with ever thought I was going to write a book, so it kind of doesn't seem fair. But it was a Fairbanks-based bush commuter and charter company, which everybody in Alaska is familiar with that type of operation. And I was lead dispatcher there for 4 years.
Oh, wow. And so was this just kind of, I'm going to go to Fairbanks. Was there other airlines you considered in other parts of Alaska?
The guys that I knew were living in Fairbanks. Oh, so Fairbanks was where I went, and that this was where they were working. So it was almost a year after I got to Alaska before I had the job there. And opening was there. Everybody knew me, and I had it.
Nice, great. Did you look up the weather in Fairbanks before you moved there?
You know, I was a surfer in Florida.
Oh, no.
And I didn't used to get in the water until it was 80 degrees. So it was a radical change, but, you know, I wanted that. It was an adventure.
That's part of the adventure, exactly. So would you say that this was bush piloting? I mean, there's a term that we use in Alaska, but yet in the book you don't say that. I don't know if there's...
Among commercial aviation in Alaska is, it's two different things. First, it's scheduled, which is just like Delta and Alaska and everybody else. You have a published schedule. Everybody knows how that works. And then it's also on-demand charter. And these guys, the commercial operators, are your airlines like ERA or Wings of Alaska here, that type of thing, that don't land so much on gravel bars or out in the boonies on fields. They're not lodge pilots so much. And that is more what commercial pilots think of as bush pilots. If you go outside anybody that gets in a cockpit is a bush pilot in Alaska. Hmm. That's their perception of it. But in Alaska, among pilots, it's a finer definition. So I don't use it so much in the book because they were commercial pilots. So, you know, the guys at Aero wear shirts and epaulets and ties. So they look just like Delta pilots.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, I worked for many summers in Valdez at Aero.
There you go.
From college and high school. And it has changed over the years. I noticed that now I'm back in Alaska. I don't think it's owned by the same company. It doesn't have as much relation to Alaska. And that's kind of what you say about the company that's been around and around Alaska and changed over the years, right?
Right.
Since its inception?
The company that I work for is actually no longer in business. They went out of business a few years ago, again, which is not uncommon for small airlines in Alaska. But a lot of them do radically change. They get swallowed by bigger companies. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happened. Aero is just part of a big merger now with multiple Frontier Flying Service, mm-hmm. Hagelands. Yeah, it's a lot of them that joined together in there, and they're much bigger.
Okay. So how did the company change over the years? Did it start out small? And then why did it actually decide to merge, I guess?
Well, the company that I worked for, which was not Aero.
Okay.
I talked about Aero, and I want to make sure that's clear.
Yeah, I should have thrown that in there.
And part of why I refer to it as the company in the book is also because they're all so much alike. So what we experienced at that company in the mid-90s out of Fairbanks is exactly what any other pilot or dispatcher would have experienced in 2005 in Anchorage or 2007 in Bethel or 1992 in Barrow. They're all very similar. All the accidents are very similar. All the day-to-day business is very mm-hmm. similar. The demands of the passengers are all very similar. So you didn't have to work for one specific one to know this story. It's all the same okay. story. When I went to work there, it was small. We got bigger. And by the time I left, they were operating out of multiple outstations, which is where Fairbanks is the base. But you can also have outstations in Bethel and Barrow and Kotzebue and Nome. And those are just smaller operations that feed off the big one.
Okay.
And it got bigger. And then we were, you know, taking tourists up in the summers and doing things with the big tour companies and all that kind of thing, which is all good. They all change over time, and then they get smaller, too. And eventually that one did go out of business, but long after I was still gone.
Were there always a certain number of pilots that were working for this company?
Yeah, probably. You know, I've never sat back and thought about the number of them.
Could you highlight a few in the book?
I highlight a few in the book, and one of the things that I had to do in the book, and I explain this in the preface, is I combine the stories of many pilots down to a cast of few because it would have been too hard to keep track of two dozen different guys over an extended number of pages. So I gave you a few, but when you read the book, you'll see that they're purposely, they're not really identifiable. I don't tell you what they look like because they stand in for each other.
Mm.
So stories that I assigned to Scott or Sam in the book might have actually happened to four or five different guys. But again, they're very common stories that happen to everybody that's ever flown commercially up here, all of them, being really cold, being really scared, having airplanes that are a piece of crap, stuff like that.
Yeah, maybe we'll get some time for some of those stories. But so when I was showing this book around, people were like, wow. And actually, I was reading on the airplane last night with high school kids, and they're like, I'm scared of flying. Why does that say dead pilots? People are like, where did this title come from? What was your...
The title is actually one of the chapter titles in the book, and... You know, my publisher is an East Coast publisher, as many of them are. And we actually, I wasn't sure if they were going to go with this title, if they thought that it might be too much. And I didn't want to suggest with the title that the book is noticeably tragic or overwhelmingly dark and tragic, because there's an awful lot of humor in it, maybe some black humor. But, you know, there were a lot of funny days, a lot of good days, a lot of really wonderful friendships that were there, too. But a lot of the guys that we knew didn't make it. And they didn't make it for preventable reasons. There's a perception outside that the flying is so hard in Alaska that you just can't avoid the accidents. But when you're here and you know the cause of each individual accident, a lot of them are avoidable. And, wow. and that makes them perhaps even more difficult. But the chapter that this is based on is about that. It's about a lot of the different guys that I knew that I had either worked with or knew of. Some of them weren't close personal friends, but we just knew them through someone else that it happened to, and we decided that's it's kind of a big point of what the book is about, so we went with the title.
And following on that question, who did you hope would be the audience? Is there one particular one? Are we trying to educate people outside of Alaska or even us inside about our own realities?
There was two different groups that I was writing for. Partly it's very personal. It's for the people that I worked with. And we were starting to forget. And some of these people I'm still very good friends with and will remain friends with forever. And we're starting to forget the names of people that we worked with and some of the circumstances of what happened to some people that we knew. So I wanted to write it down so that we would always remember what we had done and what it was like. And if you go by the place where we worked, and that's one of the things that I say towards the end of the book, it's like we were never there.
Really?
No one would ever know. This is a company that's out of business, and aviation companies in Alaska come into business and go out of business all the time. That's one of the stories of aviation in Alaska. And you're gone, and it's over. And so I wanted to write it so for us. So there is a record, and we all have children now. So there's a record of what we did and who we were. And then part of it is also there are a crazy amount of reality TV shows about Alaska now that are just really out there.
I haven't seen them, but I'm sure you have.
Just on everything. I mean, I'm sure the fishermen roll their eyes and the gold miners roll their eyes and, you know, the guys who drive trucks on the haul road roll their eyes. You know, it's all kind of, the Coast Guard. It's kind of gotten crazy cakes. And so part of why I was writing it, too, was there's this huge misconception that flying in Alaska is always, if you don't get to the village right away, people will die. If we don't get these passengers there right away, people will die. If we don't get this load of paper towels and potato chips that are U.S. mail to Bethel, people will die. I mean, it's almost become that excessive and absurd. So I wanted to show that, you know, sometimes it is just being a bus driver. Sometimes it is just like that, which doesn't mean that it isn't still hard and crazy and anything else, but it's not people will die every 5 minutes. And I wanted to kind of push back against that a little bit. So
do you bring some of that up? I mean, I didn't get a chance to read everything, but the mundaneness of flying and all.
Sometimes, yeah. It's thousands of pounds of mail and passengers and freight and sled dogs and wedding cakes and Halloween pumpkins and Kentucky Fried Chicken and Chinese takeout and Domino's Pizza. And hunters from outside who come up here with their espresso machines and their sourdough starters and their $5,000 guns and say, do not touch this rifle case, boy, because you might damage it. And the cargo guys will just kick it across the ramp, you know. So there's a lot of, that, which is really, how different is that from working, you know, for anybody in the lower 48? There is a lot of that goes on as well, you know. And then in one of the chapters in the book, you know, sometimes even the flights that you think, you know, this is an emergency medevac flight where, you know, somebody has come running into the office and said, you know, in Galena, and they said, we need this plane that's on the ground right now. We can't wait for anybody else. This kid's not going to make it. And then we find out that even the cases where we think we really did save a life were not as straightforward, you know, as they appeared on the surface. So,
do you think some of this reality show, or do you know anybody, first of all, that was in the reality show? It is based in Alaska, right?
The flying one?
Yeah.
I don't know them personally. I do know of them, but I don't know them personally. But I know where they fly in and out of and all of that kind of stuff.
Like,
That's all I'm going to say.
All right. It's not all that TV shows you. So we're talking with Colleen Maunder, if you're just tuning in. Map of My Dead Pilots, The Dangerous Game of Flying in Alaska is her book, recently published in November. So I'm sure there's been people reading it. Have you had any reaction? How has the response been?
The response has actually been really good. Surprisingly so. It's, you know, it's an independent publisher. It's not one of the great big six publishers, so you don't have a lot of money behind it. So people are finding it. And what's really cool about the internet now is that they will email the author, something that didn't used to happen.
Yeah.
So I get a lot of emails. I mean, I've gotten dozens of emails, a lot of them from pilots in Alaska, not necessarily commercial pilots, but private pilots or that type of thing. And they like it. They've told me that it's said what they wanted, what they think is true and what needed to be said. And that's pretty cool. They have a lot of questions, you know, and they're always trying to figure out what, you know, who the company really was and that kind of thing. But the people that know, and that's enough. But it has gotten a real positive response. I'm pretty heartened by that. That to me, at least if Alaskans think it's worthy, then I know I did a good job. That was my biggest concern.
Well,
people in Lower 48 are fine.
Don't believe it. Okay, positive response is always nice. And actually, on Amazon, I was looking through some of the comments, and they were very high reviews.
One horrifying one star. It was an awful review for me, but then it was said awful things about Nick Jans, who blurbed the book too. It was like a drive-by bashing of Nick, which was kind of funny too.
Yeah.
But Amazon reviews, you kind of have to take with a grain of salt. Any review, really, you got to get a thick skin about that.
They seem to be mostly positive. So, let's see here. There's a lot of stories in the book. I know we can't talk about them all, but there are a few that you like to highlight as your favorite or something that the audience out there should remember.
There were a lot of funny moments. There is only one living pilot in the book who I did use the pilot's real name. There's a lot of history in the book, Eielson, Merrill, Ween, and those, you know, obviously their names are used as is appropriate. But my friend Jennifer Nelson, who is no longer flying, she lives outside right now and is married and has children. Jen, I asked everybody one day, and Jen actually flew for the competition, but I asked all my friends one day, you know, what's the strangest thing you ever flew? I mean, come on, there's got to be something weird in there. And Jen was actually flying the Anaktuvik girls basketball team on a charter from Barrow down to Anaktuvik, and she was in a Beech King Air, okay, she's a 15-seater. And she was up there, and one of the girls showed up with a dead frozen seal, about 120 pounds, as excess baggage.
No.
And so she wanted to take it home with her, and, you know, Jen was like, yeah, I don't think so. That thing is not going to fit in the plane, so she's just going to leave it there. And, of course, the guys who are running the base in Barrow are like, if you leave this thing here, how are we going to get rid of it? And we have to get rid of it, and, ew, big dead frozen seal. So they got underneath the plane, which is where the belly pot is on the King Air, and used their feet to kick this solid frozen thing in there and told Jen, all right, go to Anaktuvik and get it out. So she flew down to Anaktuvik with her co-pilot, and they got under the plane, and they got this thing out. And the last picture, you know, in her head, mental picture she had was, here goes the girls walking down the runway in Anaktuvik, and one of them has a rope tied around the neck of this dead frozen seal. So you would think that is the weirdest thing that she ever flew, but then she said no. About 6 months later, she flew to Keketovik, which is up in Barter Island, the very tippy top of the world. And when passengers get on board from the village, the pilots have to ask them, you know, their names and weights and what baggage, and they write it on the manifest. And he had a box, and the box was leaking. And she said, you know, okay, so what's in the box? And the gentleman said, a head. And so Jen dutifully wrote down one head in box, you know, 10 pounds. So we said, well, what kind of head was it? And she said, seriously, you know, are you going to ask a person with a leaky head in a box what kind of head it was? So she didn't, and those were the two strangest things that anybody flew on top of the wedding cakes and the pumpkins and the, 7,000 pounds of candy we flew to a village once that had 575 residents, which was pretty epic, but lots of stuff like that. But the dead frozen seal and the head in the box.
Yeah.
And so I asked Jen if I could put her name in the book because, really, she needed to be immortalized for that. And obviously that's not the kind of story you're going to get in trouble for. So
no, of course not.
She was fine with that. So, yeah, there's a lot of really funny things. And I think most people in Alaska kind of already have an idea that there's weird stuff that goes on the airplanes. But until you've seen the mail show up and there's a 10-speed bicycle with a little tag hanging from the handlebars with an address on one side and some stamps on the other, you just can't wrap your head around how really wild it is. And it was not at all the way I was told it was going to be in college.
Oh, really?
So, but those were some of the things that I wrote about.
So Those are some of the stories. Now, on the other side of that, there's these pilots, these fascinating people that come up to Alaska, or they're already in Alaska, and were born here maybe. And on one of the pages, I don't know exactly what page, but there's a quote that says, what they left behind was always nearly part of why they came through the door. And so pilots must be drawn to this career for different reasons. But what did you try to
mean by that? They're kind of like everybody else. Everybody has their own specific reason. Most successful pilots have a love of aviation. They've always wanted to fly. I learned to fly when I was 18, primarily because of Tom Cruise and Top Gun, which had a huge impact on me that summer before I started college. But I was never a confident enough pilot to go on to a professional career. So I have my private pilot's license, and that was where I stopped, which was very useful for any sort of career that you have in aviation. I think it's exceedingly important that you know how to fly. Mm-hmm. But when you go on and you want to become a professional pilot, you have to love flying. But to come up here, a lot of the guys that I worked with were running from something or running to something. Mm-hmm. Either they hadn't made it back home, or maybe there was, you know, I think I have a quote in there somewhere. It says their fathers never understood them. Their mothers, you know, were too busy. Their siblings overshadowed all their achievements. And everybody fit into that niche on some level. Or they came up here because they had really big hopes of making it in a big way. And Alaska is the place that you come to get flight time much faster than you can in the lower 48. And I don't want to say it's more extreme flight time, because flying is always just flying, but it is a lot of unique environments in Alaska, big space, and depending on where you fly, and you can go from extreme environments over the course of a day, whereas in the lower 48, if you're flying in the southeast, you're just flying in the southeast. So they came for different reasons, and most of them then move on, really. Some stay.
Huh. Would there ever any pilots that showed up, you're like, this guy's a little sketchy. I wonder what
they were
coming from.
They did not make it. And we could tell when they walked in the door. It was pretty obvious. I have a thing in there. There was one guy. You have IFR or VFR, so instrument flight rules or visual flight rules. And then we invented, you know, another, like, NFR for his name, because it had to be perfect. You know, it could be IFR, it could be VFR, and only if it was completely perfect was he going to fly. And we knew he wasn't going to make it, and he didn't. He left after a couple months. And his story would be, I'm sure his story became that he was pressured to do things that were dangerous. And I'm sure that's the story that he tells to anyone who ever finds out that he flew up here. Our story would be that he was unwilling to fly to the minimum required standards. And that's what I think was true. He wasn't comfortable in it. There's other guys that were maybe running from bad marriages, and that's just changing your geography. It's not changing who you are or what happened. And so then to drop yourself into a high-action environment where you have to do a lot of work really fast and have your head screwed on straight, and you still don't understand what happened in your marriage or the girl you left behind or whatever else. Yeah, so we knew a lot of times. But the biggest thing was they had to come. You would get phone calls all the time from people that would say, I want to be a pilot, but the first test is walk in the door. And it's the guys who will come all the way and walk in the door that get the shot. And I'm sure that is something that they're seeing big time because of the program being on the air right now.
The TV show. The reality show.
Yeah.
And when you think of pilot, or most of the time it's a man, but you just talked about Jen.
Yeah, Jen.
I don't know if over the years you saw increased number of females, if you're seeing that now.
It has not increased. You know, even back when I was in school, just in an aviation management program, so just a classroom setting on aircraft regulations, there would be 30 students and 4 would be female. So it's a very male-dominated industry, period. Up here, there were, I can think off the top of my head, of probably 8 or 10 women compared to maybe 70 or 80 guys that I knew over the course of the time, which is really not that bad.
Yeah.
But they were there. Jen's the only one that I have in the book. The main characters are not. And again, that was because I knew such a small number of females that it would be very easy for people to figure out who they were. So I didn't do that other than her. Well, come on. It's a seal sickle story. You had to put that in there. But yeah, there are some females. I think it will eventually get better and better. There's no reason for it not to be.
Of course.
You know,
I physical.
It doesn't matter. The flying is something where it completely does not matter. Physical strength is a non-issue. Mm-hmm. So it's just a traditionally male job that's taken a while.
Yeah, it will change. Yes. So aviation, and we don't have a whole lot of time yet left here, but I really want to touch on how you think it plays a role or has in Alaska's identity in shaping who we are as a state.
Aviation is critical to Alaskan history and who Alaska is still today. Some of the greatest pilots in American history were Alaskan bush pilots in the 1920s. Ben Eielson, Noel Ween, Russ Merrill, Merrill Field, Harold Gillam, Jack Jeffords, Joe Crossan, great pilots. I mean, these are guys who are in the National Aviation Hall of Fame. These are guys who are in the Smithsonian. They're not just Alaskan heroes. So Alaska could not be what it is as a viable state without aviation in it, for sure, when it was on the road to statehood. And airplanes were what brought everybody together. Mm-hmm. And still today. I mean, every time you hear something from Washington about how they want to shut down rural airports, the senators are immediately like, go to Alaska and see what it's like. It's just a critical thing to Alaska's economy and to keeping Alaska one place. One United State. Without aviation, it would not work. The guys that came in the 20s, though, their vision was Alaska as a crossroads to the world. And their vision was realized. And those 747s come into Anchorage every day from all over Asia. And Lufthansa, everybody comes in there. And it's because Alaska is the place that they come through. It is the crossroads. So they were right. They saw it in the 1920s. It just took a while for the world to catch up.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the future? Any changes in aviation? I mean, I know some people don't stop through Anchorage anymore on the way to Asia, right? Because planes can fly.
I don't, I think Alaska is always going to be critical because of its location and because of what it offers, the big planes. It was kind of a joke that when the weather would turn bad and they would all come into Fairbanks, they would, there's a dozen different languages going at once,
really.
But I think what I would love to see in Alaska is it would be great if more money could be poured into aids for navigation. It doesn't have to be as dangerous as it is here. And part of why it continues to be is because it always has been, and people think, oh, well, it always will be. And it doesn't have to be. But it's money. And it's changing that culture that says, well, it's more dangerous here. Pilots die here. It's what happens. And it doesn't mean that people are fine with that. But it seems to be more acceptable here, both to outsiders and to people in Alaska. Hmm. And that's one thing that I think does have to change. And technology is a big part of it. And the other part of it is the pilots themselves and the companies. But again, when what's being sold is glory stories, you're going to get young pilots that are looking for glory. Hmm. And a lot of times those are the guys who find a mountain instead. So,
yeah, wow. Well, I hate to end on a sad note, but you're going to have a great time.
About the frozen dead seal again.
If you're listening in tonight, we've been talking to Colleen Mondor. She wrote The Map of My Dead Pilots, The Dangerous Game of Flying in Alaska. It is out on the bookshelves at Hearthside as well as online. She'll be speaking about this around Alaska the next couple weeks, and we wish you the best of luck with that trip. And
thank you.
Keep making us aware and raising awareness on these issues.
Thanks.
So thanks to the listeners. We'll be back next week here on the Alaska Identity Project on KTOO News Juneau. Thanks.
You're listening to KTOO FM Juneau.
Are you concerned about an elderly person, wondering what to do? You can help. Call the Senior Outreach Gatekeeper Program. They help seniors struggling with substance abuse, mental health, or age-related issues access services to remain safe and independent. To refer a senior in Juneau, call 463-6177. In Hoonah, call 866-746-6177.
This program of Southeast Senior Services is funded in part by the State of Alaska Division of Behavioral Health and the City and Borough of Juneau.